So a few years back I was thinking about the Buddha. I was reading the Pali Canon. I think I might have been reading the Chula Satchaka Sutta, which is one I told a story of a few weeks back in the class. And in that sutta, the Buddha is not at all like a Buddha, I thought. If I had this idea of the Buddha as very kind of meek and mild and gentle and always smiling, as it were. But in that particular sutta, he's quite fierce. And it quite struck me. And I thought it's quite easy for us to think of the Buddha as perhaps almost being without personality, without character. So not like an ordinary person, almost like something that everything has been bleached out of. So he's just this white character. But I don't think Buddhas are bleached. I think he's probably still got colour in him, as it were, in his character, in his personality. But it's quite hard to tell from what we've got in the Pali Canon and so on, in the sutras and suttas, what the Buddha was actually like as a person. The Pali Canon is obviously, it was written down several hundred years after the Buddha lived. So before that, it was an oral tradition. And as with any oral tradition, there's going to be distortions, but also there's a lot of devices that are used because it's an oral tradition. So there's lots of repetitions, for instance. You need repetitions to remember things. There's lots of stock phrases and stories. Stories obviously keep things in the memory. But of course the canon was written down at a time when there was a monastic tradition. And those monks, had their own take on things, had their own agenda, as it were. So they would have emphasized certain things and perhaps not emphasized some other things that were less interesting to them. They had their own their own lives, but their own things they wanted to promote and things they didn't want to promote. And I think what happens in the Pali Canon is you get a lot of teachings which come across, the teaching comes across, and you get lots of repetitions and stock phrases and so on, which you have to kind of sift through. But also you catch glimpses of the Buddha. Particularly in the stories, you catch glimpses of the Buddha. You catch glimpses of a person living their life. And that's kind of what interests me in the Pali Canon. I'm interested in the Buddha as a person because I'm also interested in the fact that it's often the person that communicates something rather than the words or whatever. So for instance, I'm sitting here giving a talk. You're hearing what I'm saying, but you're also picking up a lot. That's just me, as it were, who I am. And the same applies to you, obviously. If you're talking to me or whatever, I'm looking at you. Your whole bodily form, your facial expression, how you hold yourself, the tone of your voice, all of that communicates something. So how you live your life communicates something. How you are in relation to other people communicates something. So I'm quite interested in that aspect of the Buddha, what he communicated through his life, as it were. We can't obviously get to his tone of voice and his facial expressions and so on. We can maybe imagine them, but we can't really get to them. But we can try and catch glimpses of him interacting with other people and just get a feeling for what was that like? What was he like interacting with other people? And maybe some of it is what we'd expect and some of it might be surprising. So yes, I'm going to talk about the Buddha in the Pali Canon. And maybe first I just say a little bit about the Pali Canon. I know probably many of you, if not most of you, are probably familiar with it, but just a little bit about the Pali Canon. As I said, written down maybe 200 to 300 years after the Buddha's life. preserved because it was in Sri Lanka. The Sanskrit sutras and so on were not preserved because they were in India, and Buddhism was wiped out in India. So they are only preserved in translation mainly. But the Pali Canon was preserved in Sri Lanka. It consists of three parts, as it were. There's the Abhidharma, which is the kind of mind or psychology teachings of the Buddha, unlikely to be part of the oral tradition, I think, more likely something that came later, systematization by the monks and so on of those teachings. The Vinaya Pitaka, which is the rules of conduct of the Pitaka, by the way, means something like a basket, so it's divided into three baskets. The Vinaya is the rules of conduct for the monks, and usually each rule comes with a story about how it arose, why that particular rule was brought into being. And then the most important part, I think, is the Sutta Nikaya, the discourses of the Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha, and that's where we draw most of our teachings from, and so on. Not most of our teachings in Sri Ratna, but in basic Buddhism, most of it comes from the Sutta Pitaka. That's again subdivided into five parts. There's the longer discourses, the middle length discourses, the connected discourses, the numerical discourses, and I think the other one is the miscellaneous discourses. There's usually a miscellaneous in most of these lists. So the miscellaneous discourses. So that's divided into those five sections. I haven't read all of the Pali Canon. I'm not sure. Has anyone here read all of any of the... No. All of the Sutta Nikaya? No. It's a lot to read. I've read quite a lot of it, but not all of it. But there are some excellent books about the life of the Buddha, which you can draw on. People have done a lot of research. I particularly like the relatively recent one by Vishwapani. I think it's a really excellent book on the life of the Buddha. It's very well researched. But there are other books on the life of the Buddha, like Nyanamoli's Life of the Buddha, which is kind of uses an imaginative technique for drawing out what the life of the Buddha was like. Or even there's a small book called Warrior of Peace by an order member called Jinananda, which is a good book on the life of the Buddha. I think it's important that we do try to familiarize ourselves with the life of the Buddha. I mean, after all, he's the founder of Buddhism, and we're trying to practice within that tradition. So it's quite important to familiarize ourselves with what the Buddha was like and his teachings. I suppose as an aside, it's important for us to familiarize ourselves with the life of Sangharakshita, because he's the founder of our particular tradition of Buddhism. He's our most direct link with the Buddha, in a way, because the lineage comes from the Buddha down to whoever your teacher is. It's quite good if we familiarize ourselves with the life and teachings of Sangharakshita. It's actually interesting also to see the parallels between the life of Sangharakshita and the Buddha. So what was the Buddha like? Well, the first thing that strikes me is he was a very determined and disciplined practitioner. I mean, you get that from the stories about his earlier practice. You get it from the stories he tells about himself in his time before he became enlightened, that he was determined and disciplined. There's a sutta in, I think it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, called Dvedhavitaka Sutta, something like that, where he talks about his life before he was enlightened and how he maintained this constant mindfulness of his mental states. So he was noting skillful mental states, unskillful mental states, and he was noticing this all the time. In fact, he says in that sutta that when it became too intense for him, he would rest by meditating. You know? Um, yeah. He also showed determination in when he left home, because he left home against the wishes of his parents. I mean, there are lots of long stories, but the shortest story is where he just says, I left home even though my parents didn't want me to. They were weeping and they didn't want me to go. So he left home. He showed, he was quite a determined character. Vishwapani reckons that he probably wasn't as old as some of the stories say when he left home. And I've often thought that myself, that actually it's unlikely he was whatever age is usually said to be, 29 or something. I would have thought he was more like 19 or even earlier. But we don't know for definite. So he was determined and disciplined. He also loved solitude all his life. He was very much in demand, you could say, as a teacher, and he had a lot of disciples, a lot of followers. But nonetheless, from time to time throughout his life, he would simply head off alone for a period of solitude, and he always spoke very highly about that life of. The life in the wilderness, the life of wandering, the austere, the simple, even rudimentary life of the wanderer. But he also valued friendship, and that comes out quite strongly in the suttas. He valued friendship in terms of ordinary terms, but also he saw that teaching the Dharma, or spreading the Dharma, giving the Dharma to people, was the obvious thing for someone like him to do, the obvious practice for himself and the obvious practice for his most advanced disciples. He sent them off, the first 60 or whatever it was. He said, go and teach the Dharma for the welfare of others. And he spent his whole life, from his enlightenment to his death, wandering, teaching the Dharma, wandering from town to town and teaching the Dharma. So I see that as a form of friendship in a way. It's a form of giving friendship to people. But he does have teachings which are more directly about friendship. Probably the most famous teachings on friendship are in the given to Ananda and to Meghiya, both of whom were companions. Meghiya earlier on, Ananda for the last 25 years of Buddha's life was his constant companion, and Meghiya was his companion presumably sometime before that. So I'll be going into the story around Meghiya much more in 2 weeks' time. He basically tells Meghiya that for someone, what does he say? When the heart's release is immature, spiritual friendship is the most important practice. To Ananda, he says something much stronger than that, in a way, because Ananda is on retreat, as it were, and he has this thought that he's making an effort, and that the effort he's making must be at least half the spiritual life. And he thinks, well, and friendship is probably the other half. So he comes to the Buddha and he says to him, spiritual friendship is half the spiritual life. And the Buddha says, not so, Ananda, not so. It's the whole of the spiritual life. And in the Sanyutta Nikaya, where that comes from, the next story is about Sariputra coming to the Buddha and saying, friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. And the Buddha says, good, Sariputra, yeah, you've got it right. It's an interesting story. It's worth thinking about, because what does it really mean? Especially if you think in terms of what Ananda was thinking about, effort. Because is the implication that effort is not important? What does it mean for the Eightfold Path, which includes effort, and so on? I don't think it means that effort is not important, or that the Eightfold Path should be just sevenfold or something like that. But it's worth thinking about, what does it really mean that friendship is the whole of the spiritual life? So the Buddha was a many-faceted character. He had a huge impact on his contemporaries. You get that time and time again with people approaching the Buddha. He has a big impact on them. And, of course, he's had a big impact on the world. Although it must be remembered, I think it's worth remembering, that actually Buddhism might not have had such a big impact on the world if it wasn't for Ashoka, the much later emperor who made it the religion of his empire. It's again something interesting to reflect on how religion becomes more widespread. In the case of Christianity, it's to do with Paul, or Saul as he was, and his road to Damascus experience. He was going to Damascus to persecute Christians, and he had a conversion experience, and then he became the most ardent kind of disseminator of the teachings of Christ. And Ashoka had his own road to Damascus moment. He, after the battle at Kalinga, seeing all the dead and wounded, he was converted to pacifism, converted away from that life. So he was a warrior, you could say, who became a follower of the Dharma and adopted Buddhism as the religion of his huge empire, and he made big efforts to spread it far and wide. And that's probably one of the reasons Buddhism has, possibly the most important reason why Buddhism has spread so much. But nevertheless, the Buddha did have a big impact in his own lifetime and beyond, and presumably he had an impact on Ashoka. The Buddha himself was destined to be something like a chieftain, probably a kind of warrior chieftain. Not a king, I think, as the sometimes said. There was the Shakyans weren't that big, as it were. They were just a clan. But he chose to forego that life that was there waiting for him, as it were, and took up, well, possibly a life of even greater hardship, as it were, battling with life's existential questions. And, well, he did that, and obviously did it with a lot of success, and others have taken up that challenge down the generations, and they've left us this rich inheritance. This is what we've inherited. Because Bhante took up that challenge, we've inherited the way it's come to us. So the Buddha, as I said, is a many-faceted character, and what I'd like to talk about is some of the qualities that I see depicted in the Pali Canon. So qualities like his gentleness, but also his firmness, and even his fierceness, his pragmatism, his fearlessness, his physical toughness, and his revolutionary nature. So I just want to have a look at some of these qualities, or perhaps might cover all of them. So in his communication, invariably you find him being gentle and courteous. So with Maggia, for instance, and I just mentioned earlier, he's quite gentle. He's very patient in a way, and doesn't push things. Or later in the summer, we have Viryajyoti talking about the story of Kisa Gotami, and in that story, he's incredibly gentle and patient with Kisa Gotami, and very empathetic and so on, very kind, and at the same time showing her the reality of the situation. But then in another story with the monk Badali, Badali was a monk who was very publicly disobedient, as it were. So as a monk, he should have been obedient, but he was very publicly disobedient. And the Buddha was very firm with him. So Badali publicly announced that he wasn't going to keep one of the rules. The reason he gave is because it caused him some discomfort. Yeah, that was his reason. But at the end of the rains retreat, they were on their rains retreat, Badali's friends urged him to go and as it were, get back into communication with the Buddha and to apologize. And Badali does that. He goes back to the Buddha and he apologizes and says, "I was wrong." But the Buddha doesn't immediately forgive him. might think is a bit tough, as it were. And the reason he doesn't is he wants Badali to understand the effect that his actions had on other people. So he had an effect on the other monks, he had an effect on the nuns, he had an effect on the lay people, he had an effect on the reputation of the order and so on. So he wants Badali to understand all of this, and when Badali does understand it, then the Buddha forgives him. And actually in the sutta they go on to have some very good communication about other things. It's an interesting little sutta. You get this feeling in the sutta, at least I do when I read it, that they've had this kind of clash, as it were. But once that's cleared up, they're able to have a much better communication, and they go deeply into other things. And it's even quite an intimate conversation, because at one point the Buddha says to Badali towards the end of the sutta, previously he said, you weren't listening, and now you're listening. So it's quite nice. The Buddha could also be very fierce when occasion demanded. So that was the case with Satchika, whom I mentioned earlier, and Samamati will talk about him in a few weeks' time. Satchika was a very boastful character who liked to debate with people, but he always boasted about how good he was and how he would beat them and so on. And he gets humiliated. Then there's another occasion when the Buddha meets with the king of Kosala, who's called Prasenajit. Prasenajit comes to visit the Buddha for the first time. So Prasenajit was the biggest king. He's the king of all Kosala. So that included the Shakyans and the Kaliyans and the Phajiyans and so on. So although the Buddha's father was a chieftain of the Shakyan clan, he was actually a vassal or whatever of Prasenajit. And Prasenajit was a young king, not easily impressed. So when he met Gautama for the first time, his first question was, I have heard that you claim to be a fully and perfectly enlightened Buddha. Is this true? And the Buddha replies, if that can be said of anyone, it can be said of me. Then Prasenajit says, but there are great sages who have been practicing for many years who don't make that claim, and you are young still. And then the Buddha responds, and he says, great king, there are four things you should not look down on for their youth: a warrior, a snake, a fire, and a perfect monk. Do not underestimate a young warrior. One day he will gain the throne and punish you with his royal might, so avoid him if you value your life. Do not look down on a young snake. It slithers along, shimmering with vibrant colors, and one day it may bite the fool who scorns it. Do not disparage a fire that is newly lit. Someday it may burn you. If it grows, it will become a great mass of flame that feeds on everything and leaves a blackened trail behind it. When a fire burns down the forest, the shoots grow up again. But if a perfect monk burns you with his potency, you will not acquire sons or cattle, and your heirs will not enjoy wealth. They will be barren and airless, like the stumps of palm trees. So when I read this, I think of this as being the Buddha being like a shaman or a magician. He's faced with someone who exercises worldly power, and he speaks with words of power, as it were. It's an assertion and a kind of warning. It reminds me of the much later story in the life of Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava is quite fierce or strong in relation to worldly power. So though the Buddha could be gentle, he could also be firm, and he was even capable of this fierce kind of flashing forth of what you might call shamanic power, depending on what the situation demanded. So it's his communication is appropriate, as it were, to the situation. Another quality that he seemed to have is he was quite practical. He was usually practical or appropriate. He communicated what was needed, as it were. There's a story in the Brahmajala Sutta, which some of you will be familiar with, in which the Buddha is with his followers is going along the road, and two followers of another sect are on the road at the same time. I can't remember the names, but there's a teacher and a pupil, and the teacher is constantly criticizing the Buddha and criticizing the Buddha's followers. The pupil is actually defending them. Anyway, they all stop to rest at some point, but this constant criticism just carries on, and eventually some of the Buddha's disciples, feeling exasperated, go to the Buddha and tell him what's happening. And his response, I think, is very practical and also instructive. He says, if anyone should disparage me, the Dharma or the Sangha, you should not feel angry and resentful or upset. That would be a hindrance to you. Just explain what's incorrect. And if others praise me, don't feel elated. Just acknowledge whatever is true. He did add, listen to the sound of water in the clefts and in the gullies. The tiny streams gurgle loudly. Mighty waters flow in silence. So he's saying, empty barrels make most noise. Yeah. This story, Bhante wrote an essay prompted by this story, well, prompted by other things, but based around this story, this incident. And he wrote that essay to argue that Buddhism should never support laws against blasphemy. Buddhism doesn't need to be protected in that kind of way. There's an essay called Buddhism and Blasphemy. It's well worth reading. And when his relatives, the Buddha's relatives in the clans of the Shakyan clan and the Kaliyan clan, when they were going to go to war with each other over the water in the river Rohini, because the water was dwindling and they both wanted to use the water, he again was very practical, persuaded them to cooperate basically rather than kill each other. He persuaded them by getting them to understand the sacredness of human life, you could say, or the value of human life compared to the value of the water. Yeah. He was also, he developed fearlessness. He talks about developing fearlessness and talks about how he did that. And he also developed physical toughness, because the stories tell us that he had quite a privileged upbringing, so he wasn't necessarily bred to endure the hardship which he later did endure. So when he was practicing, before gaining enlightenment, he deliberately put himself in situations where he would experience fear. And then he would just face the fear and let it wash over him in waves, as it were. So he talks about this in a sutta in the middle length sayings, the Majjhima Nikaya. It's called something like the Abhaya Bhairava Sutta or something like that. Anyway, he says, I dwelt in such awe-inspiring, horrifying abodes as orchard shrines, woodland shrines, and tree shrines. They don't sound very horrifying, but you have to remember what this was: ancient India and jungles and so on. And while I dwelt there, a wild animal would come up to me, or a peacock would knock off a branch, or the wind would rustle in the leaves. I thought, what now if this is the fear and dread coming? I thought, why do I always dwell expecting fear and dread? What if I subdue that fear and dread while keeping the same posture that I am in when it comes upon me? While I walked, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither stood, nor sat, nor laid down until I had subdued that fear and dread. While I stood, fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked, nor sat, nor lay down until I had subdued that fear and dread. While I sat, fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked, nor stood, nor lay down until I had subdued that fear and dread. And while I lay down, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked, nor stood, nor sat down until I had subdued that fear and dread. So this is a kind of extreme version of feel the fear and do it anyway, isn't it? He basically trained himself in fearlessness by just facing it and facing it and facing it. And his whole lifestyle demanded a lot of physical endurance, a lot of toughness. Both he and his followers were very tough. They slept rough in cold and heat. They walked long distances. They subsisted on a very uncertain diet. There's one story, I haven't got it here, but it's a story about someone coming across the Buddha sleeping on just on rough ground in wet weather when he was quite old. And they're really concerned about him. It's this farmer or something like that. But the Buddha says he's quite happy. He says, no, I'm quite happy here. He's not at all bothered by this these deprivations, I suppose, privations. One of the impressions I get from the Pali Canon is that the Buddha was quite unpredictable. I don't mean unpredictable in the sense of being unreliable, but spontaneous and responding to the situation in front of him, creative, you could say, in his responses to whatever situation came up. I think he probably, if we were to meet him, he's not a person that we would be able to second guess quite easily. You wouldn't necessarily know how he's going to respond in that situation. We might be surprised by his responses. Which again is interesting, because I noticed myself recently, I was listening to something Sangharakshita was saying about, I think it was something to do with the Metta Bhavana, but I remember thinking, that's surprising. I was surprised by what he said about it. Sometimes you can be surprised by the responses of someone who's a bit more advanced. I think maybe one of the things that comes across strongly about the Buddha is that he was quite radical for his time, for his place. He was quite radical in his departure from conventions and so on. You could say his insight into reality made him a spiritual and social revolutionary. So for instance, he rejected the division of society into caste, that division according to caste. He even tried to subvert the language of caste by talking about a Brahmin as someone possessing certain qualities rather than someone born into a Brahmin family. In speaking about livelihood, for instance, right livelihood, and speaking about livelihood as in terms of ethics, again, it goes against the notion of your livelihood is assigned by your caste, as it were, because livelihood went with caste. But he's saying, well, no, it doesn't go with caste. It's your livelihood is dependent on ethics. Ethics is the most important feature. I was thinking recently, actually, even this spiritual hierarchy of stream entrant, once returner, non-returner, and arahant, and so on, it could very easily be a kind of answer to or an attempt to undermine the social hierarchy of the four castes of workers, merchants, warriors, and priests. And in the order that he established, in the order of wandering mendicants, no distinction was made with regard to caste. And when he first began teaching the Dharma, he was very successful in gathering followers quite quickly. In a way, he went to Rajagaha and gathered a lot of followers, but people started to get annoyed. And call him a homebreaker and a destroyer of families. There's a passage in the Mahavagga of the Vinaya. It says, at that time, many distinguished young Magadhan noblemen led a religious life under the direction of the Blessed One. The people were annoyed, murmured, and became angry, saying, the Samana Gautama causes fathers to beget no sons. The Samana Gautama causes wives to become widows. The Samana Gautama causes families to become extinct. The Buddha's response when he was told this, by the way, was, "This noise will not last long. It will only last 7 days and then it'll be over." Which may have been correct. Although it's interesting, I was reflecting that in the early days of our movement, Bhante was also accused of being anti-family. So perhaps the Buddha wasn't quite right in saying it would blow over in 7 days. There was also a lot of controversy in his Sangha about allowing women to go forth, because this went against all the norms of a traditional society where women were wives and mothers. You could say, in fact, that women going forth threatened society's kind of norms in a much more direct way than men going forth. And the early women wanderers had a very hard life indeed, because even the monks were opposed to the wandering Sangha, including women. And after the Buddha's death, Ananda was criticized by the other monks for having supported the women's case, as it were. But the Buddha's message went even further than caste, in a way. There's a meeting with a herdsman called Daniya, and in it the Buddha states his position, as it were. I just quote from Vishwapani's book. Here's how Vishwapani describes it. "One day, not long after his awakening, Gautama was walking through the swamplands near the river Mohi when he fell into conversation with a herdsman called Daniya. Daniya told Gautama that he'd been preparing for the rains," so he's preparing for the monsoon. "I've cooked my rice and milked my cows. My family live nearby in a well-thatched house and the fire's been lit. So I say, let the rain come down." Looking askance at the wanderer's rags, Daniya remarked, "I support myself by what I earn through honest labor. My sons are all healthy, and I never hear a bad word about them." And the Buddha says, "I serve no one. Having found liberation, I wander through the world with no need to earn anything." And this dialogue, I think, shows, in a way, one version of his message to, you could say, to mainstream society, which is a complete rejection of worldly values and what he would have referred to as something like the cramped and dusty householder life. At the end of the discourse, Mara pops up to defend possessions. But Gautama tells him, "One with sons grieves because of his sons, and one with cattle grieves because of them. A person's grief comes from possessions, and someone without possessions does not grieve." So he might not have been very impressed by our consumer society. Anyway, of course, not everyone could or would renounce a household and a family life. And also, of course, the wanderers depended on the householders for their food. Yeah. So a more, you could say, down-to-earth, but still quite radical teaching about ethics developed for those who wanted to stay at home and live the householder life. The Sigalavada Sutta, which I was looking at this weekend with some people, has detailed teachings on this as a code of conduct for the householder. It's sometimes known as the lay person's Vinaya, the lay person's rules of conduct. And it relates to all the major relationships in your life and so on. There's a code of conduct. So, although he was for himself and for his monk followers, he rejected the householder's life. He didn't reject householders, if you see what I mean. He did teach the householders and interact with them. And I think the Buddha's message is, it wasn't just radical and revolutionary for his own time. I think it still is, in a way. I mean, saying things like that your suffering is largely caused by your own mental states, as we get in the beginning of the Dhammapada, that's quite radical. You can do something. You can do something about your suffering. Nobody else can do it for you. You're responsible for your own mental states, for your life. So even today, I think that's quite radical, especially because we live in a culture which is quite a culture of blaming and complaining in a way. And he says or implies that religion is whatever works to alleviate suffering and transform people in the direction of wisdom and compassion. So he's saying there's no God or even guru to save you. You need to follow the guidance, but you have to take the medicine yourself, and you have to save yourself in a way, which is quite a radical redefinition of religion. Or even saying that spiritual practices, spiritual teachings, are a means to an end. They're not ends in themselves. This is also quite radical. And of course, his message about where happiness comes from is still radical in our shopping culture. So he says there's no lasting happiness to be found in worldly things. Therefore, accumulating wealth or possessions doesn't bring lasting happiness. In the end, we have to let go of everything. And I suppose basically saying we have to train ourselves in letting go. We'll be happier if we train ourselves in letting go. And in a world like we have now, where some people are willing to kill or be killed on the basis of some real or imagined insult to their teacher or teachings, I think it's quite radical for the Buddha to say that he and his Dharma do not need to be defended. Buddhism doesn't need laws against blasphemy. Anger because the Buddha is denigrated, or pride because the Buddha is praised, are equally unhelpful on the path. And this is quite contemporary, because you do have Buddhism being mixed in with nationalism in places like Burma and Sri Lanka, and people preaching hatred against non-Buddhists, which is really atrocious. But Buddhism is a radical teaching. It's strong medicine for a sick world, you could say. And Bhante, Sangharakshita, has continued this tradition. He's presented the Dharma in a very clear and uncompromising way. And, of course, he's been criticized for that as well, as you'd expect. So the Buddha obviously expressed his teachings verbally, what we've got has come down to us through the oral tradition and the written tradition. But his life is also a teaching. His life, those 45 years after his enlightenment, so devoted to other people, devoted to helping others, devoted to trying to clarify for people what life is really about, what's important in life, what you can do to become happier, more complete person, and so on. That life of constant communication of something meaningful, that life itself is a teaching. And his life also, the way he lived his life, communicates a message of non-attachment, of letting go, of not grasping after power, not grasping after wealth, not grasping after security. It's a very uncompromising and radical message, which is actually quite easy to understand, but quite difficult to do, as someone famous said, who was a Bodhidharma, easy to understand, but difficult to do. You could say, I suppose, that most Buddhists in the world live a very diluted version of the Buddha's message, including our good selves. But I think it's far better to live out the Buddha's teaching in an imperfect way than not trying at all. I think in this practice of the spiritual path, the ability to practice, the ability to practice grows as we practice, and our understanding develops gradually. And all we need to do is put the right conditions in place. And we learn something from the Buddha's life. We learn something from the Buddha's teaching about what those conditions are. He's constantly telling us what those conditions are. We may not be able to do it exactly as he did it, but there are enough hints and clues as to the direction of travel, as it were. And I think if we can do that, if we can put those conditions in place and begin to grow and transform ourselves, I think we'll be doing something that the Buddha would have commended us for. I don't think he would have been fierce with us. I think he would be quite gentle with us. Yeah. That's all I wanted to say tonight. So we'll have a tea break now. One of the reasons I like doing puja is because it does remind me of the Buddha. Yeah, particularly the short puja when we do it, and those lines, something like, we are born as the Buddha was born, and what the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. What the Buddha attained, we can... It really reminds me that actually the Buddha was a person who lived and did these things like facing fear and all the rest of it. So do join us after the tea break and we'll have a little puja, short puja. Yeah, thank you.
That is holding power, yeah.